one of my long-lost friends on the show today, the great Ed Begley.
Bozos.
I'm
Begley.
Oh, yeah, I thought you had a kind of a big nose.
You recognized it, huh?
Yeah.
You'd like to give it a squeeze?
Oh, no.
Oh, come on, squeeze the wheeze. Many people like to. Here. See, it doesn't hurt me.
No.
You know, I think we're all
Begley
on this bus.
Oh. Yeah. My mother was
Begley
at school.
No kidding. Well, you know, my ma always said, you got to start young if you're going to stick it out.
Junior!
Bill Proctor, I love you. Do you know that I love you?
Yes, good. I do, and I love you, too.
And I know that, too. How do you like that?
That's great. You over all these years, and over all this distance, when you love somebody like we love one another,
yes,
you feel it, and I think of you. You know,
I think of you a lot.
It's amazing, isn't
Ted
it?
Ted doesn't know this, but I'm a fanboy for the Firesign Theater. I'm a total fanboy from the late 60s, you know, Antelope Valley Freeway and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Crush the Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers.
Pliers, yeah.
All Hell, Lennon and Marx. I mean, Nick Danger, all of that. Just such a fan.
Same here.
Yeah,
so
the best
great.
Of the best. You are.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Well, we're here also to talk to you about your book, which is such a delight to read and to get into. And we'll talk about why during the show today.
Great.
But the book is called To the Temple of Tranquility and Step on It.
That's the right response. Thank you both for that. Good, good.
Is there a story behind that?
There is a story. First of all, it's a line not written by me. I put it on the cover of the book, but it was actually uttered by one Dick Stahl, a wonderful...
Richard Stahl, yeah.
Richard Stahl, great. You probably work with him.
Sure.
Great improv actor. He did lots of films and television, but this did not happen in front of a camera or an audience. He had planned, after the Beatles went to see the Maharishi, he wanted that kind of enlightenment and that kind of guidance, so he planned, as I would plan, very type A personality kind of a thing. He had a flight going from LAX to Hawaii. From there, he transferred to the Philippines, get on a very inexpensive merchant marine vessel where he got a berth on that somehow, and then go to a smaller vessel and get off and go to the dock and go to the little rickshaw or something to the Temple of Tranquility.
Ooh.
But that first flight was late. Something happened bad in L.A. or Hawaii, and he got there late, just running down the jetway, just closing it up as he got there, the jet to the Philippines. He had to wait another day. But then the rain started. It was monsoon season.
Oh, God.
And he couldn't get another merchant marine vessel for weeks and weeks. And he finally got there, and he got the other boat, and he ran up the dock, and he hopped into the little rickshaw and said, to the Temple of Tranquility, and step on it. And he started to laugh. The driver started to shake his shoulders and laugh, and he didn't want to lose his tip. But it was ridiculous, of course, to say such a thing. But he said it, and he knew it was absurd, and he began to find tranquility in other ways, as did I.
Oh. You sure did. This book, I read it cover to cover, just amazing.
Well, you should have read in between, because that's all the good stuff.
Oh, yeah, really? I just did the sleeve.
Yeah.
Tonight, Dr. Me throws the book at superstition.
I'm not asking you to believe in a book written by a bunch of babbling barbarians over 2,000 years ago. I'm asking you to believe in a book, some of which was written as recently as last night. This is fresh. How do I know? Hell, I wrote it. Who am I? I know who I am. I'm the Reverend Dr. Me, Chief Dendrily, and the living word in Kudzu County for as long as I can remember. Remember what? What was I talking about?
And you should remember to be watching later tonight when Dr. Me presides at the Harvest Virgin Sacrifice.
Your life is
not over yet.
It's not over yet, but it's remarkable. And, you know, talk about a zealot of who you've met and how you met them and what it led you to, and then all of your incredible experiences, and that you survived, and how all this...
All the people in your life.
You know, Ed,
you think of yourself as a character actor. You're a character liver.
What other organ in your body has stood up for you like your dick?
Well, certainly not your heart.
Yeah.
That organ gets broken when you're young and breaks for good just before you die.
Right. It's not your liver. That wimp can't handle the massive amounts of alcohol you're drinking because you're depressed over neglecting your dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, not in the sense of a
liver.
And my liver has a lot of character at this point.
But yes, you've met so many interesting characters in your life, you know, and responded so well to them, bonded so well with so many of them.
And Ted Zelig is it. You put your finger on it. You know, I don't know what year that movie was made, but it's based on a real person, as it turns out. Zelig
was. It? Really?
Yeah, that's what I'm told. But that's very much it. When that came out, I went, well, that's me.
Yeah.
I'm either, you pick, Zelig, Chauncey Gardner, Forrest Gump. That's me. I'm like, I'm jogging through, you know, past the Washington Monument when historical events are occurring. And I somehow got invited. How did he get here? Oh, Harry Nilsson invited him. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you're okay. Come on in. Crazy.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you meet, very rarely do you meet people who have had the variety of experience and coincidences that led you to such wonderful things over the years. But it's really just the definition of a life well lived.
Thank you. I feel the same. I just feel very lucky. I finally got gratitude at about age 30. I didn't have much of it before that, but I realized how lucky I was to be born Ed Begley's son, to get to work with Phil Proctor and all these other great people that I work with over the years. How lucky. You know, I was an ingrate for years. My dad made it look so easy. I thought, well, I want to be an actor. Get me on Gunsmoke.
Tell us about your dad, quickly.
My dad was an Academy Award-winning actor, a Tony Award-winning actor on Broadway, a big hit.
I saw him on Broadway in Inherit the Wind.
You probably did with Paul Muni, maybe, and Melvin Douglas did it as well. But he was a great star, a wonderful radio actor, too, something I know you care a great deal. He was
indeed
in Richard Diamond, Private Detective, Aldrich Family, great radio shows, but he made it look so easy. I had this attitude, well, I want to do that. If my dad had been a plumber, I'd be fitting pipe now. But he did that and made it look so easy. I went, you know, give me a Gunsmoke. Give me a Perry Mason. I want to, not just one shot, I want to be a regular on the show, for God's sake. Where's my series? Wake me when I'm famous. And I didn't put any work into it. Finally began to train with the help of Bruno Kirby and others. It was such a great example to me. Began to take some training, and then I began to work.
You worked with Peggy Fury.
Peggy Fury was a great teacher in my life. And Stella Adler, of course, was great. And many other wonderful teachers.
Ex-Norwegian wife's sister worked with Stella Adler. She was her organizer, kind of.
I probably met her then. She was great. Stella was wonderful, and I remember she had an assistant.
Anna Semmingsen.
That's sounding very familiar. How do you like that?
Isn't that wild?
I was supposed to do a scene with Susan Clark, and I couldn't make it. Suddenly, I just didn't show up to do a scene with Susan Clark in front of Stella. Everybody was upset with me, but then I got word to them why I couldn't be there. I was in jail, a story we might get to impersonating an
officer. How you managed to survive. You were a raging alcoholic.
Yep, quart of vodka day.
Yeah, honest to God. And Harry Nilsson was even more of an alcoholic.
I know. I decided to outdrink Harry Nilsson. How stupid am I?
Good luck.
I don't recommend that.
No.
But then John Belushi calmed you
down. Was a sobering influence on my life. John Belushi was very much worried about me.
That's amazing.
Too far. Ed, I don't mind parting myself, but you go too far.
Now, you mentioned in the book, you know, you say, I had white privilege. You know, you mentioned that. Because, you know, of your dad. But at the same time, your dad did not embrace the show business luxuries, and he was pretty straightforward.
He was very, we lived in Van Nuys, a very modest home, a two-bedroom home.
Yeah.
But also, having said that, he also had a home out in Long Island, another modest two-bedroom home, but we were wealthy enough to have two homes, small ones albeit, but
in Merrick.
Beautiful Merrick out there in Long Island, a good place to grow up.
I grew up in Huntington.
Oh, really? Yeah. How do you like that?
I left when I was 10. I think Long Island is one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's just too bad those people are there, but, you know.
Yes, exactly. I left when I was 12, so I can relate.
Yeah.
And then
there were potato fields when I was there.
Yeah. There were lima bean patches across my house in Van Nuys back when I was born here.
Right.
Went to New York to go to grade school, but came back every summer to the San Fernando Valley, to Van Nuys, and finally relocated here in 1963 for high school, and I've been here ever since.
Wow. So you were here in what to me was the halcyon days
definitely,
you know, of when there were still orange groves in the valley. And
a lot of oranges. People were growing corn in the valley still, you know, and lima beans, as I said, right across from our house.
Yeah.
Right there in Van Nuys, there's Sherman Way and Sepulveda.
Okay. Yeah. So you came up through this time, and your dad was famous and doing quite well in the business that you ended up loving. But then, you know, you talk about in your book about how you discovered these family secrets, because your dad wasn't terribly vocal about...
No.
some complications.
His private life.
Yeah, I finally got my hands on my birth certificate for the first time, because to get your driver's license, you need the proper ID, which is your birth certificate.
Right.
Because you don't have a driver's license yet, you need that. So I get the, my dad just hands it to me. We go to the business manager's office, and he gets in the car, and we start driving back the valley from Beverly Hills, where his business manager was, hands me the document, just starts driving, and I open up. What does it look like? You know, is it written on parchment with a quill? With a little baby footprint on it, so we don't get mixed up at birth here. So I started to look at it, and something caught my eye right away. Not something that was written on it, something that was not written on it. It was no mother's name.
No mother's name.
No.
Wow.
And often you'd see no father's name. That's more common.
Right.
But no mother's name. She was clearly there in the hospital. Why didn't put her, why did they not put her name down? So seeing that there's no mother listed for me in my birth certificate, I said, Dad, why is there no mother's name on my birth certificate? Long pause. Finally he goes, because Amanda wasn't your mother. The woman I knew very much to be my mother. She died when I was 7. I called her mommy. That was my mother. Mother of 3 kids, Tom, my much older brother, my sister Aileen and me, I'm the youngest. And suddenly, Amanda's not my mother. I go, well, who is? And he goes, Sandy. 20 megaton bomb in my head. Because this woman that I loved like crazy, I would see her like Christmas, Thanksgiving, you know, Easter sometimes, and she would give me a gift, and I just was crazy about this woman. That turned out to be mommy.
Wow.
And who was it? Well, what did she do? She was a page at NBC. My dad had taken up with a page at NBC, had not one but 2 kids with her, and just brought them home to poor Amanda. I don't know how that worked. Here's 2 kids I found in the alley.
Yeah, right.
Can you change them? I got to run to a play.
Oh, that son of mine.
He's not your son, Fred.
Stop torturing me, Ethel.
And you were one of them.
I was one of them.
Wow. Oh, we're talking to Ed Begley Jr., and who you may remember from
everything,
hundreds of movies, incredible movies, but at, you know, Saint Elsewhere, of course, television was one of your most high profile.
Changed my life, that show.
Sure
but,
did.
But, all right, so, and we'll get on with this, but this is fascinating to me because it seems like you were sort of born into an addictive personality. And the story, the reason I ask is because your dad would drive between the two houses when he was doing Broadway and Hollywood. Sometimes you would drive across the country.
He would.
And you found in Nevada, when you were driving one day, you found the one-armed bandit, the slot machine.
Exactly. What a magical thing that was.
Something lit up in your brain.
You put a quarter into it or a nickel into it, depending on the denomination of the machine, and you would get a jackpot, which I knew I would get the first time I put a coin in, because that's what the universe owed me.
Of course.
I was going to get that jackpot because it was owed me.
His name is Aloof Maloof, and he owns Great Satan's Towers, where you boys went and took
some
of these
slides. That's well, right. I see the connection now. I wasn't hip to the jive.
I didn't know that. I knew your name, sir. I've never
really Aloof, you. I understand that you own a big athletic team right now.
That's right. Vegas is not my only. It's not the only dice I roll.
Yeah. Aloof. Oh, it is a dice rolling team. Dice
no,
ball.
No, not dice ball. This is b-ball.
It's b-ball.
Yeah, it's b-ball. I own the Sacramento Kings.
Oh.
And you may remember 2 years ago when we were up against the Lakers, or the Fakers, as we call them in Sacramento. We burned their jersey in effigy, and ever since our team has been cursed. So I've decided to change my luck and come out here to Vegas and make things happen with my new casino, Great Satan's Tower, the tallest building in Vegas.
Aloof. That brings us to some
magnificent
theme music.
Building, yes.
We and had we a have great, sent out our time. Two yeah. wonderful local news personalities, Ray and Hal. And Hal, Ray, what's that first slide
coming? Well, let's
coming
take
up?
A look and see. This is actually
it's a cost picture. Me a fortune.
That's a picture of our bathroom. We had it remodeled recently. I don't know how that got on
I
here.
Thought that was one of
that's
our
that's the tub. That's the hot tub.
Can
it's
you get
nice.
To my
yeah,
hotel?
Well, I'm
a
sorry.
Busy guy here.
I didn't have a chance to check these out.
I got
that's
games
the
to fix.
Exercise machine.
Now, wait a minute. And is there that Hal on the exercise machine?
Well, let me go back and see.
Would you check that? Yes, that is. This is actually the exorcise machine. Have you heard of an exorciser?
See, his head is turned all the way around the wrong way.
It's one of our big sponsors.
The Devil Master?
Yes, it
yes,
is. Here's
yes, indeed.
We have one of those in our sports club right behind the Ghost Bar.
Oh, and here we are. Here we are in the
there
elevator,
it is.
Going up in the elevator now. And you can see I've got a picture of the...
Well, that's a picture. That's a picture of the mirrors in the elevator. And
yep. You see the numbers, though,
yes.
You see?
Yes. Oh,
that's
going
very
up.
Confusing, this part.
I thought this was interesting because you see the numbers seem to be moving.
Let me explain why the numbers are moving.
Why?
You see, because our elevators work off of the Keno machine. So the only floors you can get off at are the numbers you hit in Keno. So say, like, you bet on 34 and it doesn't come up and you're on the 34th floor.
There we are.
You got to go back to the casino until you hit.
Hold it on that one, Ray.
All right.
So I finally convinced my dad, who is not at all a gambler, because my older brother Tom was, and it didn't end well for him. I convinced my dad to put a quarter in the machine. Maybe I had three of them. Yeah, I think I had three of them. I said, put some, and he did one at a time.
You were too young. It was 21 and
yeah, you couldn't go in. It was at a, like a gas station kind of a thing. They had some slots there. It says, you must be over 18 or whatever to play. So I saw him put in. He had his back to me, but he put a quarter in, nothing. Second quarter, nothing. The third quarter, nothing. And he turned around and shrugged his shoulder and went, see? You know, and I was convinced. Here's what I thought. I didn't think that I'd lost the money. I thought my dad somehow faked putting the quarters in.
See, now that,
he hadn't really done it.
That's so
That's where my mind went.
Yeah,
it couldn't possibly be that I didn't get my jackpot that it was over.
Yeah, he was a hell of a good actor.
He was. Yeah, he wasn't that good at pantomime. I've seen him play pantomime.
How old were you then?
I was 12 years old, I think.
So this is an interesting crossroad because most, you know, I don't know. If I was 12 and I saw my dad.
Oh, it was 10 or 11 now that I think about it.
10 or 11. That's what you said in your book. Now, if I was 10 or 11 and I saw my dad just lose three of my quarters, I would go, I'm not going near that thing again. That's a loser thing. But something just lit up in your, you know, this strange idea of gambling. And I think that is that, you know, I don't want to get deep into this, but.
No, it's very much what the book is about, addiction, just trading one form of addiction for another.
Exactly.
Drugs and alcohol, philandering, gambling, you put a name on
it. All. You did it all.
I did it all. But when I first played bingo before I discovered poker, I would just play bingo at the kind of Horace Heights Estates there on Magnolia. They had a bingo thing.
Oh, Horace Heights Estates. I have some friends who live there now.
I lived there for years, and I was convinced that I was going to win, you know, whatever the big prize of the night was from bingo. It didn't work out that way. I just kind of knew that that was my destiny, to be handed everything, like handed an acting career. And I didn't, so I didn't put a lot of work into things. But finally, I began to work and study, and things changed for the better.
Listen, I heard a show, the late Gilbert Gottfried was interviewing Ileana Douglas.
Oh, yes. Two good friends of mine, by the way.
Good, good. And she was talking about her dad.
Melvin Douglas.
Grandfather, yes.
Grandfather,
Melvin Douglas,
right.
And she asked for some advice about going into an acting career. And he said to her, always order the club sandwich.
That's a great bit of advice.
Isn't that? He said, they always have the same ingredients in it, no matter where you are.
That's like Betty Davis. What's the secret to success in Hollywood? She goes, take Fountain. Which is a street in Hollywood for those who don't know in other parts of the country.
Yeah, a major street we all know too well.
As you grew up, you went up, you spent time with Groucho Marx. You became friends with Marlon Brando, Jack Nicholson.
Really
you played
close.
Trivial Pursuit with the Clintons when he was still a governor of Arkansas. You got to know Kirk Douglas.
With Malcolm
Meryl
McDowell
Street.
And Mary Steenburgen.
Correct.
Right?
My
Richard,
dear friend.
Up in Ojai.
They got us up to Ojai. We wound up moving there. They had a realtor there the next morning after we first went up there with Mary and Malcolm. And we quickly rented a house and then bought a house there. I loved it up there. It's beautiful.
And you played Trivial Pursuit with?
With the Clintons, with Bill and Hillary. Yeah.
How did that go?
We won the game, but we kind of lost in a way because every time I saw Bill after that, I said, you know, Pope Pius XII was not the correct answer to that question. It was what was on the card, but it wasn't. I think he was right, actually. I think, but what was on the card was Pope Pius XII, so we got the final wedge for that.
Well, you had the same experience with Dick Clark, because, all right, I knew Harry Nilsson also.
Oh, I loved Harry.
Oh, God, wasn't he something?
The best.
I want to get into this.
When I met him, I believe, from my memory, he was working as a bank teller.
He worked at a bank running the computer in the
basement.
That's
what he did.
Yes, he did.
Because he was a mathematical genius.
He was. He ran a mainframe computer in Panorama City or somewhere.
And you have a mathematical brain,
a bit
too.
Of it. Not like him, but I have had a pretty good brain for that stuff. I can tell you the calendar trick. I could do that pretty well.
The calendar trick? All right. Well, so I was born on July 28th.
What year? Let me pull up the calendar first.
1940.
Okay, let me do 1940. I've got it. It's a leap year, by the way. Sorry. Go ahead. 1940 is a...
July 28th on a leap year.
28th, it's a Sunday.
It's a Sunday, that's right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Because
I'm not looking at my phone, folks. I'm
not
in front of a computer.
No, he just did it.
He just did that.
My mother held off giving birth to me in Goshen, Indiana, until it was midnight and Sunday.
The Sabbath.
Yeah, and also Sunday's child is full of crap or whatever whatever the poem says.
Loving and giving and da 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 da.
She wanted me to full of grace or something.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
And you are, trust me.
But when you were on the Dick Clark show, he asked you what day they started the show, gave you the date, and you said it was a Monday. And he said, oh, no, it was a Tuesday. But as you pointed out, that's what it said on the card.
Right, the researchers. And actually, just to fine-tune a little bit, it was Dave Letterman. I was on the Letterman show, and he was
the date was
a Dick Clark American Bandstand, the premiere of it.
And Okay.
And so I said it. I did the math of it and came up Monday. So I said, Monday. Ooh, I'm sorry. It was a Tuesday. I went, shit. They cut that out, of course, in the Dave Letterman show.
Whoops. On KPFK.
Sorry. And I went, I did it again and came up Monday. So I just kind of accept my fate. I don't know what I was doing wrong. What I was doing wrong was believing him.
Yes.
Not that he was trying to deliberately do it. The writers just got it wrong. Why would a five-day-a-week show like American Bandstand start on the second day of the week,
Tuesday?
Yes, of course.
It doesn't make sense.
It was on a Monday.
That's ridiculous. Right.
So I was right, but...
You were right, but David,
tell that to my wife.
Yeah, I'll tell it to you. All right. How do you remember the thing that I found absolutely most fascinating about your book and why I like diving into it is that you seem to have a total recall of things that happened to you and people that you met along the way. Do you research to do this? How did you do this?
I have it in my brain somehow still. I still remember us in the Mountain Dew commercial. It was a very smoggy day,
yep.
And you were at some point in an inner tube. You were riding in an inner tube in a little stream that went by.
Yes.
Why do I know that? Why do I not know why I went into the garage today just before I came here? I had no idea why I walked in the garage before I got in my car to come here. There was something that I needed to do, and it was to get my water bottle, and here it is.
I brought it back.
But I couldn't remember that, if you had a gun to my head. But somehow I could remember you in that inner tube in 1972 in a smoggy day out in Santa Clarita.
Not only a smoggy day, but that was on some movie ranch.
Yeah, the Disney Ranch.
The Disney Ranch. And I remember you were wearing a mask.
A gas mask, yes.
Wow,
your memory is very good, too.
It's true, you know, they got cars in heaven. They run them on milk and honey. They got milk and honey smog. If you think gasoline smog is bad, you ought to walk around in ozone and honey, man.
God bless you, Pastor.
God bless you. But the thing is that when we go to heaven, we're going to have our gas masks because it's our fate. My fate is my gas mask. I got it.
You're on it,
I got it. My fate is my gas mask. I can believe it because I can breathe it,
I can't breathe it, but I can believe it, dear friends.
Dear friends, I don't need my nose to know. No. Take away the mask and you die. My mask is my faith, dear friend.
Gas mask.
Air for sale, friends. It doesn't matter where I'm coming through. Charcoal clean, friends. Charcoal clean.
Charcoal clean for me. I've got a filter tip activated, friends.
Yes,
I've got
indeed.
Charcoal on the inside.
My faith, friends, is charcoal activated. I'm making small shorthand movements to show you that I believe, but I am not in good physical shape like you, dear friends. No legs, dear, no eyes. This woman is dead and she should be alive. What are we going to do, dear friends, when we get to heaven and the air is so bad that we can't look into God's eyes because he's got a full face gas protector -AD14 gas mask on. Can't look into his eyes. The seraphim and the cherubim are wearing gas masks. Smaller ones, but gas masks. Elijah and Muhammad and Amos and Ezekiel and Zebekiah and Balthazar and all the people sitting on his right hand. Must be mighty painful. They got gas masks on, too. And Jezebel and Dirty David and Samson on the other side and all the clopotic demons. Why, they're going to be wearing gas masks also hidden by their hideous features. So, friends, you need some faith. You need a mask, dear friends. You need to talk through the charcoal purity of faith, dear friends, and I can give it to you. Not me. Not me, but the great gas mask inside me. Yes, dear friend. We got to breathe pure, clean air. Not oxygen. Not the oxygen of lust and temptation. Not nitrogen, friends, but Xeron. Pure, unadulterated Xeron, friends. Canisters of faith awaiting for you down here at the No Breathe Fee Air Can't Beat It Church. of your dear friend, Pastor Ralph Radio Voice. I'm going to hand over the pro. Oh, dear friend, somebody just laid a whiff of Xeron on me. And I'm not here anymore. Oh, no, I'm up with my gaw.
This broadcast is brought to you by the Giant Golden Gas Mask Church of Faith, Downey, California. The sign of the former hamburger stand where Reverend Flash conducts these airless services every Sunday morning.
Somebody let some of that nasty oxygen in this church. Get him!
KFOX, religious programming.
Well, well, I just came out of the bastard studio.
The bastard studio?
No, the pastard studio.
Excuse me.
Boy, it's really strange in there, man. Totally, all that small.
It's weird in religion land. Religion, you know, is a great unknown force, man. I mean, most of us are white liberals. Oh, yeah, well, that's why we put the...
a golden gas mask is on.